The good, the bad, and the alternative. By Madame Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of Andrew Hussey. Chapter 17. Little Talks. Dave. Dave had been counting the seconds since Bro disappeared up the elevator with Jade, Rose, and back. It wasn't intentional, more like a nervous tic, he thought, but at this point, there was only so much he could do to stay awake. Despite everything, he was seriously crashing. Maybe he should ask the good doctor for one of her energy drinks. In the meantime, he did a few stretches, hoping the movement would banish his exhaustion. It didn't help. When the elevator dinged again, Bro was not the only one to step out. He was quickly followed by that hottie from when he fell off the roof, Faff, he recalled. Dave blinked a few times to make sure it was actually her, but yeah. She was looking around nervously before spotting Carcat and making a beeline to him. She was followed by a strangely disheveled Mr. Egbert, who immediately made his own beeline for John. The way the two collided into a hug. How the father lifted the son with the same ease as Jade had shown when lifting Rose. Was enough to make Dave shift his shoulders in discomfort, eyes sliding away from the scene. He loved his bro, but the two of them were far too cool for dorky displays like that, usually. Okay, so maybe Dave felt a little jealous, as he tried not to watch the open fatherly concern oozing from Mr. Egbert like custard from a donut all sweet and sticky as he... Dave jerked his eyes away from the touching reunion. It wasn't his job to stare after all, and he had a reunion of his own. Kinda. Mama was here, yes, and she'd given him a hug that made him feel safe and loved, but she was understandably busy with Kanaya. Plus her human elder thing, which Dave was starting to realize he didn't actually get at all. And Bro was busy being a hunter, which was the usual way of things. Dave fidgeted, shifting his weight from foot to foot. Dave. Bro's voice behind him came out of nowhere, and Dave did his best not to jerk in surprise. Usually he was pretty good at sensing Bro sneaking up on him, but after driving all night, Dave felt beyond strung out all fuzzy thoughts and frazzled brain. He'd been comparing Mr. Egbert to a donut for fuck's sake. He clearly wasn't in the mood to play junior hunter surprise ninja bullshit bootleg nut training for totally normal kids with a totally normal life. Dave. Bro was now in front of him, patiently repeating his name, and this time Dave did jerk in surprise. He hadn't even noticed Bro move. Exhaustion was dragging him down, making thinking a labor, making paying attention about as hard as that one guy in the myths pushing his stupid boulder up a hill. Always pushing and pushing, even though the damn thing was going to slip out of his tired grasp and bowl him over in a gory splatter as it careened its merry way down the slope. Taking any coherent thoughts with him as his metaphor spun further and further out of control. Dave, you need to sit down. And this time he felt strong, calloused hands gently gripping his shaking shoulders, steering him to the chair near the observation table that had become unoccupied at some point. The firm pressure of being forced to sit barely meant a thing. He was too wrapped up in his own thoughts. Usually the endless stream of internal chatter was pleasant, providing him with ideas for his most impressive rambles, coloring the way his comic characters spoke, and of course, providing the sickest of bars. Right now, after hours of staying focused, of corralling John and Rose, of keeping Rose from throwing herself at Vriska's fangs, jugular exposed, he'd been the strong one, the competent one, the level-headed one. He'd focused on the glowing insignia etched into his brain of a falling sword. He'd focused on Bro's instructions, even as the guilt of betraying Mama, of burying Kanaya under the pseudo-Christian trappings of a hunter purification ritual curdled in his stomach. He'd continued to hold it together through the harrowing 12 hours of night driving, dreading the answers they were seeking. The relief he'd felt when Kanaya was okay, when she was no longer overcome with that strange, inhuman violence. He thought it would be enough to soothe him. But now his mind was playing a highlight reel of the worst, most gory moments, his stream of consciousness was seeking a rhyme for ribcage, finding its answer in bestial rage. And Bro was kneeling in front of him, removing his shades from bloodshot eyes, his own eyes uncharacteristically exposed, tucking both sets into the collar of his shirt, then grasping Dave's hands, gently applying pressure as he waited, a silent signal that he was here. Dave wasn't able to find that calm anymore, his mind latching onto sickly green eyes and inhuman cries. Jesus fucking Christ, Dave needed to get it together. Just because Kanaya was okay, just because Rose wasn't going to be thrown on Hunter Mercy, he still needed to be strong. Needed to ramble about something funny and off-topic and lighthearted. Not the shattering of the hunter's blade or the eerie silence of a dead glade. He stared into his brother's amber eyes, and all he could see was the blade he'd held, the blade he'd wielded at Kanaya. At Kanaya, not a nameless, faceless monster from his childhood bedtime stories, half myth and half nightmare, at the girl who'd been Dave's first best friend, his constant in life, his wingman, his sister, if he was being honest with himself, his sister, and Bro would not have missed her if she hadn't broken the blade. Funk. He needed to stop rhyming. Dave took a deep, shuddering breath, or maybe it was just his body trembling and the breath was too small, too shallow to provide any relief at all. Was that why he was lightheaded? He was suddenly glad Bro had pulled him into the chair. He was too exhausted to consider standing, but his thoughts were slowing, no longer ripping their way free in an overwhelming tide of memory and rhyme. He squeezed Bro's hands, signaling that he was grounded, that he was present in the moment. "Were you really gonna kill her?" he whispered, lips barely moving, watching Bro's eyes as he asked the question that had been weighing him down for hours. He didn't think anyone would hear him, but this wasn't something he wanted an audience for. Bro's eyes flickered, a fast movement in the direction of the grubs, his brow furrowed ever so slightly. His hands flexed in Dave's grip for just a moment, making him keenly aware of each callus his bro had earned over the years as he held his sword and defended this city. He already knew the answer to his question. "Yes." Bro didn't look away, didn't contort his face into a semblance of regret. "I would kill anyone to protect you, Dave." No regret, because how could he regret something he would do again in a heartbeat? That was the problem with Bro, who loved Dave so fiercely, who would do anything to protect him, who found him Mama and Kanaya to make sure he'd never be alone, while Bro braved the darkness to fulfill his oath. Bro had broken that oath by not reporting the incident to protect Dave, to protect Dave's friends, because to hurt them was to hurt him, but to protect Dave from a perceived threat, he would turn that damn sword of his upon a teenager. Upon a girl he'd watched grow up, would try to sever her head from her neck and add another girl's head to the pile just for getting in his way. He supposed he was lucky that it had taken this long, that he'd gone 16 years without seeing Bro fight with intent to kill, that he'd been safe and protected. He hadn't realized he was squeezing Bro's hands tight, a white-knuckled grip, until Bro spoke again, softly. "I would have killed her to protect you. But I'm lucky that I didn't have to. Everyone in this room is incredibly lucky." He paused, swallowing audibly. It was unsettling to see him express himself like this. "If anyone other than Kanaya had died on that roof, I don't think they would have gotten back up again. Whatever happened to her, whatever happened to John, they were two completely different reactions. The doc said the curse was ancient. Something in my gut tells me it came from somewhere other than the frozen depths. Well, there was no excuse to curse what chaos sought to destroy. It's..." Bro stopped, unable to find the words for a moment. "I don't go to Order HQ as often as they would like. There's stuff I'm not privy to. Stuff I never thought I would need to know, kind of shit that's more relevant to those hunting in the old world. What scraps I gleaned from my superior's loose lips, something I saw today, it reminded me of them. Hopefully the sheriff can be enticed to overshare. Presuming we didn't fuck this up by not being there to greet them. Bro's lips tickled downward in a ghost of a scowl for just a moment. You think there's some Dark Hunter secrets that'll explain how Kanaya's still here? Dave wasn't sure how the conversation had taken this turn, but Bro was rarely in a chatty mood. He wanted to do something to help Kanaya, and if it meant grilling Bro, so be it. I can tell you I've witnessed many identification spells over the years. Good deal of them done by this wizard, helping me sort orphans since the catastrophe. It always provides a rather straightforward answer. I've never seen such a drastic, volatile, violent result. I owe it to her and to use every resource I have available. The Order loves to keep records. Kanaya is rather distinctive. In her current form, if this curse is ancient, maybe I'm not the first to come across it. Bro shrugged slightly, eyes flicking down to the handle of his sword, buckled uselessly to his belt. Prism and my predecessors reacted the same as I did. Overly poetic or tediously dry descriptions of destroyed weapons ought to catch the eye. If the sheriff proves competent enough to babysit the city, I might visit HQ myself. See what turns up. The sheriff, the reason we left Houston in such a rush was to avoid that guy catching, well, everything. Do you think he's been dicking around in our apartment or something? The thought of another hunter nosing around in Dave's things, turning his and Bro's sacred space into an investigation, he had the feeling that the unorthodox lifestyle Bro was living would be a source of strife with the sheriff. Adding in the amount of blood kept in the apartment to satiate Vriska, and then piling on the fact they'd tried to cover up a crime scene, shit. Had Dave cleaned the blood off the mop head, or had he thrown it in the sink, then forgotten it, leaving it soaked in Kanaya's blood like a goddamn flare? The thought was enough that he almost stood for a moment as if planning to run off and check, as if he wasn't dizzy with exhaustion. We actually got lucky yet again. The sheriff was supposed to send me a message when they hit city limits. They always follow protocol, and I haven't received the message yet. But I want you home. I want you to get the place spotless. In case they arrive before I'm able to wrap things up here, I need you to distract and deflect. Can you do that for me? Bro's voice was stern, a bit of strain evident. He had a lot of shit on his plate. And Dave felt the guilt stirring, reminding him that he was partly to blame for letting the shit pile up in the first place. Totally. I'll give you Sheriff the patented Strider welcome. Pizza rolls and a cold one. Let the guy beat me in a friendly round of Cool Lou gaming. Easiest shit I've done all day. Dave's voice cracked just a little as he finished speaking, and he couldn't help but wince. Yes, this would totally be easy. After no sleep and a full 24 hours of insanity, distract a guy who beheads first and asks questions, never unlike Bro, who usually tried to ask first. Subject change, little bro. How you holding up? Bro asked. His voice soft. It was a tone Dave only heard when he was very sick, very hurt, or very scared. A tone that had gotten rarer as he had gotten older. It cut to Dave's core. When he spoke, it was a bit too honest, a bit too raw. I'm barely holding Bro. I watched her die. She's okay now, but if she hadn't been so strong, if John and Briska hadn't been able to contain her, I would have watched her die again. Would have watched you kill her. Probably would have watched Rose die too, since she was so damn eager to let Vriska kill her. I thought John was dead for a minute there, and I've had the worst day in my life. Seeing shit that shouldn't be possible, I was so fucking afraid. If this is what hunters have to deal with, I don't know why he ever joined him. He searched Bro's expression as if there would be a secret answer hidden within. I'm sorry you had to see all that. When I do my job, I prevent stuff like this from happening. I failed my duty to the city, to Kanaya, to you. You translated the artifact. If I'd been more attentive, you never would have gotten that far. Dave felt the shame for his role in this whole disaster creeping back up. I still can't believe it that you translated the artifact. Didn't I tell you not to mess with cursed shit? Why would you bring something like that near our home? The wards can only do so much when you invite the monster in. Faced with his brother's reprimand at the end of his ability to be chill, Dave responded hotly, tone defensive. First off, that's about all you ever said about magic, not to mess with cursed shit. You didn't exactly sit me down with a PowerPoint presentation showing off what that even meant. Archaeology's my jam. I go on digs with the Roddy all the time. What would even distinguish this thing from something we could uncover aside from the culture of origin? Dave took a breath, preparing for his second off, but Bro was quicker on the jump. I thought I raised you to be smart, not to make excuses. What I told you was not to go looking for danger, not to invite it back unnecessarily. I let you go on digs with Megiddo because the woman has centuries worth of knowledge of magical danger enough to make sure anything dubious you uncover never makes it into your hands. In fact, doesn't she show you when she finds something that belongs in a locked cabinet rather than your bedroom? I thought you'd be learning something about ancient artifacts and the danger of dead man's magic just from spending time with her. I never expected you to be going thrift shopping for... Bro's voice had grown heated, his lecture gaining steam, and each word had made Dave's face contort with misery. Bro had stopped mid-sentence and now stared at Dave as he fought to keep his composure. Bro was right, of course. Aradia was a wealth of information, always eager to explain the significance of their findings, always quick to make sure Dave didn't end up on the wrong end of an anti-theft charm attached to ancient graves. Dave knew how to behave on digs, how to be respectful and cautious, how to evaluate things before touching them in case his telekinetic friend needed to take drastic measures, but for some reason, when faced with Rose's endless stream of dubiously magical discoveries, the lessons hadn't stuck. He'd felt something weird, an impossible change in pressure that very first time he touched the scrimshaw. He hadn't heeded the warning. Bro. Fuck. Dave spilled. I'm sorry. I knew it was different from Rose's other scavenged junk. It skeeved me out when I first saw it, but it was hard to fucking tell. I didn't think it would really work. I thought it was just freaky because it was so old or something. She brought me shit that's freaked me out before, too. Haunted dolls and shit. Rose was all gung-ho, 100% about it. 24-7 made it seem more important than reality ever since we realized we couldn't contact Jada. I don't know. I got used to playing along with Rose's bit. It was easier than fighting her about Jade's survival odds. Especially when Rose was so sure magic was the solution. So I just say, yeah. This time with the bone was supposed to be different. We staged an entire intervention. This was supposed to be our last feudal hurrah before Rogue quit cold turkey. The translation was just about communication. I figured even if it did work, it wouldn't really work. I didn't think Jay was alive to be communicated with anymore. Dave had looked away from Bro as he rambled, preferring not to meet his brother's gaze when admitting it all. He felt a double punch of grief, old and new. The first punch was a dull ache, a familiar pain. He'd already grieved Jane, already given up while Rose raged and raved. Already confronted the fact that what little evidence Rose had found all spelled out a hidden past, but nothing to prove Jade possessed a future. The second punch was sharp, shocking in its violence. Kanaya's resurrection did not erase her death, and even though she was alive, she wasn't living. Not as a human, and he couldn't help but mourn the loss of her human identity, even knowing she wasn't a mindless monster. He wondered if Kanaya felt the same confusing rush of grief despite Friska's recovery. He didn't think either of them could erase 3 years of mourning that their respective joys could burn away the sorrow. Was Kanaya grieving her lost humanity? Would she be angry knowing Dave was? He watched the way her hands dangled loose at their sides when she was hugged by Feff. She'd done the same when Mama had hugged her, stiff and scared, hesitant to touch someone she loved, afraid of this new, strange strength. and all the other ways she'd been changed during the 12 hours of her death. She'd spent enough time with Aradia to know ghost life wasn't easy, that the flashbacks could drag her under if she wasn't careful. Would the same rules apply to Kanaya? With her cold skin and unbeating heart. She was a vampire's remix, to be sure, but that came with more to mourn. Vriska had eaten chocolate cake with wild abandon. Kanaya couldn't eat a single saltine. Bro was doing his classic silent warrior thing, letting Dave's thoughts wander. But the silence became grating as Dave waited for another reprimand and heard nothing. He turned away from watching Kanaya watch Feff's blood fill vials for the doctor. He resigned himself to looking Bro in the eye again. Bro's brows were furrowed again, and the frown was more pronounced. But still he knelt, still gently holding Dave's hands. If Rose, if any of your friends, starts talking about performing untested rituals again, you need to get me immediately. If you touch an object and it gives you a funny feeling, you need to stop touching it and get me immediately. Past few years, I've tried to make you street smart. Able to handle yourself if an angry alt came swinging. I never taught you what kind of alternative dangers a human can wield. The forms they come in. Part of that's because Dr. Lalonde keeps any other on the books magic uses out of the city. The other part is because if you know what to look for, you can look for it. Didn't want to make the same mistake Dare did. Since the cat's out of the bag now, I'll teach you when I get a chance. Bro let go of Dave's hands, and for a moment he wondered if the conversation was just going to end, just like that. Instead, his brother leaned forward, embracing Dave in a hug. It wasn't dramatic like the one he'd seen Mr. Egbert perform, nor as soft as Mama's. Bro's arms were solid with muscle, not something Dave could relax into, but the strength in his arms comforted him all the same. They were arms that had always comforted him. As far back as he could remember, Dave knew he was safe in Bro's arms. That was what mattered. You keep growing up, little bro. Your mistakes can only get more risky in this new world. All I want to do is keep you safe from the worst of it all. I'll never want to find you. Splattered in blood, a victim of your own ignorance. If that blood happened here, I don't know what I would have done. It's my job to protect you. Let me. Bro's voice was so damn earnest, open and raw with emotion he usually kept hidden, that Dave's eyes prickled with tears. He clung to Bro like a little kid, burying his face in Bro's shoulder. They were both kneeling on the floor at this point, though Dave didn't remember moving. He simply clung tighter. If you wanted to say I love you, you didn't have to get so dramatic about it. I feel like I'm in a soap opera with all these dramatic reveals and heartfelt conversations. Dave's muttered attempt at a joke couldn't dispel the absolute destruction of the Strider cool guy reputation. Instead of continuing down the shiny path of rambling metaphors in an attempt to extend the joke, Dave spoke honestly. I love you, bro. I'll listen to your lessons, I'll do better, I'll make you proud. We're doing it. We're making it happen, bro said solemnly. And as though he'd decided to take another cue from Mama, he pressed a brotherly, incredibly dorky kiss to Dave's forehead. Their reputation was going to be in a shambles. John felt his stomach twisting into knots, watching Jade and Rose ascend in the elevator. Part of him felt tethered, hooked in some strange space of nothingness inside his spine, something pulling at him as if to demand he follow the girls. He assumed it had something to do with Jade. With finally meeting her, the reunion had been cut short after all. He wasn't quite ready to let her leave his sight. But the relief that Rose wouldn't be in the room when her mother performed more magic on him, he had to admit there was some part of him that simply couldn't bear the thought of her watching, of her hungry eyes burning into him as though she could read his results faster than the doctor could produce them. There was something unnerving about the doctor. The wizard, the woman who was Rose's mom, she was gliding around the inside of her fallen circle, proud and predatory, like a shark or something. It was a bit creepy. If he was being honest, every display of her magic only heightened this feeling. And even though the identification spell had gone perfectly fine for Vriska, John was pretty nervous about the idea of that spell being carried out on him. Kanaya's hands and feet had literal holes in them, and he was pretty sure it was only her freaky healing abilities that had closed them up. He didn't relish the idea of it happening to him. John looked through the window into the hallway, watching for the returning elevator. Dave's bro had gone up with the girls, and hopefully would be in a better mood when he came back down. He was pretty sure someone had called Dad, but there hadn't really been time to ask earlier. When the elevator opened, relief swept through him. It turned out he wouldn't need to ask. Dad practically pushed past both Dave's bro and a ginger girl that must have been the owner of the whalebone as he rushed from the elevator, immediately making eye contact with John through the glass between them. In barely a breath, he'd rushed into the room, and John's heart leapt for joy as he bounded forward to meet him. He felt Dad's arms wrap around him, warm and strong, lifting him up off the ground and squeezing him tight just like Nana used to. John couldn't help but laugh just a little. As his surprise bubbled up past his lips, he clung to Dad, burying his face into Dad's shoulder and inhaling the smell of pipe tobacco like a balm. He barely felt the floor under his feet, so gentle was his dad when putting him down. What he did feel instead was the way his dad's hands left his torso, instead trailing up to cradle his face. His dad's brow was wrinkled with concern, his mouth set in a frown, beset with a disturbing amount of stubble. His tie, John noted with quiet dismay, was askew. In sum, Dad looked how John felt. Shitty. Dad. He barely got the words out before his voice broke, and his resolve with it, he burst into tears. Great heaving sobs suddenly racking him. His dad crushed him close, once again wrapping his arms around him and holding on tight.
It's okay. You're safe. Whatever happened, you're safe now, his dad murmured, mouth against John's hair. He continued to murmur comforting words as John continued to cry. At some point, Dad guided them both into chairs, carefully stepping around the broken heap Jade had left behind. Once sitting, John rubbed at his eyes, trying to regain his composure. Dad waited patiently, rubbing small circles into his back. When John's tears finally ceased, he decided to tell his dad everything. Rose had been obsessed with magic. Her girlfriend Kanaya had staged an intervention. Everyone had agreed to do one last spell. John had felt that Jade was closer than she'd ever been. He'd claimed to represent Jade's interests in the intervention and acted as though his optimism would see them reunited with her despite his lack of knowledge. They had set up the ritual, not noticing the crack until it was too late. John had suggested they fill the crack with candle wax. It was his fault. The circle had broken. He described all the horrible wrongness of the ritual. He described the monster. He described the blue light bursting forth, burning the monster where it made contact. The horrible sounds as it retreated, pulling away from Kanaya back into the skin of the seal. Then the light, so bright, so hot, snapping back like a rubber band. A sharp burst of heat against his sternum as it disappeared back inside. How it had sickened him, that feeling. And how even now the heat was present, alive within him. John had to stop for a moment after that, had to look away from his dad as he continued, sure that his actions had disappointed his dad. He knew what he was supposed to do if someone got hurt, that he was supposed to call 911, supposed to call Dad, but he couldn't. He wasn't brave enough to. John skipped through the car ride. Rose had nearly crashed the car, Vriska had snuck on board. He tried not to place too much blame on the vampire for the whole, well, mind control thing. After all, she just wanted to find out what had happened to Kanaya. He was pretty sure she wasn't really going to kill him. His dad didn't need to know about the threats. Just the part where she convinced him not to tell anyone, she sneaked along for the ride. And then he described their destination. The deep grave, the small fire, the sudden attacks. John looked up at his dad as he described Kanaya grabbing him, then throwing him. He'd flown through the air like a rag doll crashing through a tree, getting back up with only a dislocated shoulder to show for it. Dad listened with his brow furrowed, his eyes tightening with concern. Kanaya had broken a sword, but couldn't bite through John's arm. He showed off the bruises to his dad, and then explained how he'd tackled Kanaya, stopped her from lashing out at Rose. He tried not to blame her too much either. She'd been scared and in pain and hungry and angry, unable to control her new powers. Once Vriska had calmed her down, she was better, and while she was really sorry about hurting people when they got to the lab, she'd even asked John to help restrain her if she couldn't control herself. After all, she had dragon-level strength, and John had superpowers. John had superpowers. The adults want Rose's mom to use wizard magic to test me, Dad. They don't know where my powers came from, but Dave's bro thinks I might not be human, or that his hunter magic somehow soaked into me, but I'm, like, impenetrable. I bent a syringe in half when Rose's mom tried to take my blood for the spell. I had to insert it myself. She couldn't do it. She said I have control over it. That's why I was able to get the needle in. John felt his own disbelief at all he'd done reflected in his dad's eyes. Still, he had to ask. Did anything weird ever happen when I was little? With his story complete, he waited, trying not to fidget. His dad was holding John's arm, carefully examining the bruises, looking between him and the observation table in the center of the room and everyone standing around it. John had the feeling he wanted to give a fatherly lecture, right now, probably about putting himself in harm's way, but the question of John's powers hung in the air. A big, shiny distraction from the fatherly disappointment that awaited him. You were a very energetic little boy, but no, you never exhibited any strange talents. Now, your dashing good looks and musical talent, you inherited those from us, but I certainly didn't pass on any super strength. Dad smiled, a fond twinkle in his eye as he reminisced. You used to pound your little fists on the piano. If you had super strength, the poor old gal would have fallen to pieces. He chuckled. John smiled too, remembering vaguely his first attempts to play, how he'd been emulating Toulouse from the Aristocats. No real sense of how to treat the keys delicately. I guess you're right, John conceded, frowning. He didn't like the idea of his powers going away as awful as they had felt that morning. They had saved his life twice. Maybe it really is temporary. Hopefully I don't need to, restrain Kanaya again. Dad frowned at that. That was very brave of you to put yourself in harm's way for your friends, but you shouldn't have needed to do that. It sounds like you did the best you could in a dangerous situation, but the fact that you were put in that situation at all. I spoke to some very polite young people, friends of Aqueous, actually, who explained why it was important to leave town so fast. However, that doesn't mean I approve of Broderick's choices, especially his decision to keep you from contacting me. I'm sorry you had to go through all of that. I'm so glad you're safe, and that these powers kept you safe wherever they came from. We'll figure them out together. Wait, Aqueous, the centaur guy? Why did you run into him? Unsure what to say, John latched instead onto the tidbit of information that seemed almost random. I actually ended up making him and his friends breakfast, if you can believe it. That young lady with the red hair, Feferi, was among them. They were looking for you all in the Strider apartment. They're the ones who told me you were missing, showed me the roof, and called Mr. Gray over there, who organized a citywide search. John looked over at the weird, shouty guy who had come in with Jade, and the fat, pretty girl who had come in with Dad. The stony-looking dude had spent most of his time yelling at people, John having been spared by his presence outside the circle when it reformed. Dave's bro seemed to listen to him, but getting all of Houston to look for them? John assumed the roof had been the deciding factor for that, the fact that his dad had seen it. Wow, we've, certainly made a splash in town, haven't we? John joked weakly. His dad humored him with a smile. Feferi jammed the elevator call button again. She double and triple checked the address before entering, and Karkat said to message him when she was in the lobby, which she'd done. He had still not messaged back. Maybe something had distracted him? Just as the thought entered her mind, the elevator dinged, and standing in it was a striking young man with ridiculous anime sunglasses and a baseball cap. He looked like he'd had a long day. The hunter, Feferi thought with a sudden surge of trepidation. His outfit was too distinctive to be anyone else. He stared at her, unmoving for a moment before asking plainly, "You the one looking for the tablet?" It took a second for Feferi to muster a reply to the almost disinterested-sounding question.
"I am? Has Karkat Gray spoken with you?"
"Yeah, he's down there. Hop on, I'll bring you to the lab."
The hunter sounded tired. Feferi stepped on board and was hit with merely the scent of elevator carpet. She knit her eyebrows as the door closed. She was expecting the hunter to smell like something, given his disheveled state. Was it part of his training? Could you train yourself to not smell?
"Hold the door!"
a masculine voice suddenly shouted. Feferi heard loud stomps of running feet coming across the lobby. She reached over and smacked the door open button when it was apparent the hunter wasn't going to move. As the elevator doors inched open, Feferi was surprised to see a familiar face. Mr. Egbert from the apartment. He was disappointingly fully clothed this time.
"Oh, Feferi."
He turned his steely gaze to the other occupant of the elevator as he stepped in.
"And Mr. Strider, I was told by a certain young mutual contact of ours to arrive here with all the haste I could muster."
Based on the text, Feferi got it. Likely it was something more along the lines of,
"Get your lily white ass over here before I pop a blood vessel and spray everyone in this room with nasty troll ooze."
But she appreciated the decorum Mr. Egbert abbreviated the message with.
"Great, 2-1. I won't have to come back up here again," the hunter said.
He did something odd to the elevator button panel that could only be described as stroking, and another panel with a key code popped out of the wall. Aqueous would be impressed with the flushness of the seam in the metal. The hunter hid the panel with his body, pressed some buttons, and the elevator began its descent.
"I only managed to get bits and pieces from Mr. Gray. Are you here on behalf of your missing friend?"
Mr. Egbert asked her, all politeness.
"Well, yes and no," Feferi answered. "I'm here to see Kanaya, of course, but I wasn't just invited for the sake of her comfort. I think what happened at the apartment is because something of mine was found by the wrong people. I lost it during the catastrophe."
"Something of yours?"
Mr. Egbert sounded baffled, and he took his hat off briefly to push back a few strands of his tightly coiled hair that had escaped the confines of the fedora.
"You mean this item of yours was used to contact the dangerous being you mentioned on the roof?"
Damn this man's memory, it was a steel trap.
Yes. It isn't dangerous when I use it, so I need to get it back to stop anything like this from happening again,"
Feferi replied.
"That's for damn sure,"
the hunter muttered to himself. It was only a few seconds before the elevator doors opened and the hunter began taking quick steps out of it. She followed shortly behind, then felt a whoosh of wind pick up her hair as Mr. Egbert rushed past them to a door. Feferi watched through the interior windows of this hallway as he swept up a teenager that looked very much like him but with higher cheekbones and narrower eyes in a huge hug. The hunter walked in the room, leaving Feferi to figure out her own route. For a split second, it felt like she'd arrived at a party where nobody knew her, before her eyes landed on a crowded examination table in the back of the strange laboratory/lecture hall she'd found herself in. Seated atop it was Kanaya, drinking from what looked like a blood bag. Around her was Mama, Karkat, the Dave Strider, and Vriska. Feferi hurried as politely as she could across the room.
"Without them, people might start getting the idea that we don't have muscle,"
Karkat was in the middle of saying to Mama as Feferi sidled up and tapped his shoulder. He whirled around like he'd been attacked.
"Go, damn it, Feferi, don't fucking sneak up on me!"
"I wouldn't talk to you if you checked your phone."
She stuck her tongue out at him, then stood on her tiptoes to look around him. Obligingly, he stepped out of the way, allowing her to see both Kanaya and Vriska up close. Both of them smiled brightly.
"Feferi,"
Kanaya said. She sounded like she wanted to exclaim it with more energy, but looked just as tired as the hunter had. Feferi had been warned by Karkat, but she couldn't help lingering on those massive fangs and the vibrant, orangey undertones to her skin for just a moment too long. Whoa. Pixies. Vriska stood up from her chair. She looked skin and bones, but there was a light in her eyes that hadn't been there in video calls. Freedom, perhaps? Vriska found herself tearing up. Good to see you, Feferi, Mama said, smiling at her. Feferi returned it. Then the older woman stepped away to allow them their reunion.
Oh my God, I don't know who I should hug first, she said, voice wobbling.
After looking back and forth, she opted to grab Vriska by the arm and drag her within range of Kanaya so she could hug them both at once. Kanaya and Vriska both squeaked at the pressure.
I thought the blood would strengthen me,
Kanaya wheezed.
Stronger. Not immune to compression, Vriska said, equally squished.
Feferi released them from the hug and looked the two over.
Vriska, you need to stop by me in Eridan's boat as soon as you can, so I can put some proper food in you, she said, having felt Vriska's ribs poking her.
Food sounds good, Vriska nodded.
You and Eridan have a boat?
It's just a houseboat, Feferi admitted, but it's enough room for both of us. We run a soup kitchen out of it.
Vriska tilted her head to the side.
That's great, but why aren't you in the water?
Feferi's smile faltered and Kanaya spoke up.
Vriska, that's a bit of a sore topic, she began, but Feferi interrupted.
No, it's fine. I can tell her.
She touched the rough, smooth scar flesh on her jaw.
You're probably wondering where this came from, right?
Vriska shrugged. Can't say I didn't notice, but people get scars all the time.
That's kind of you, but I got this one on the same day the catastrophe began.
For a moment, Feferi's memories returned to that boat, the fire, the screams.
I was in my hybrid form, trying to save people, but something fell on me, something from a boat that was hit by a meteor, and my seal skin tore.
Shit, that's... You've been stuck in your human form, Vriska asked.
Yeah, just like the tales. Only no dashing husband keeping it hidden from me, Feferi said, trying to make light. I've been working to rehabilitate, but the healing is still in progress. I could take my hybrid form for short amounts of time, but... Yeah.
She looked at Vriska, not for sympathy, but to make sure her friend knew she wasn't helpless, she would recover. Vriska nodded, seeing the determination in her eyes.
Good. Now that we're caught up, Feferi turns to Kanaya, what the shell happens to you? We found your blood all over the roof and pieces of you in the drain and signs that my mom did something and your phone. Oh, Clav, your phone.
Feferi swung her bag off her shoulders and rifled through it, producing Kanaya's cell.
We found it in the apartment parking lot. Equius did, that is.
She handed it to Kanaya, who took it carefully, but with a small smile.
Oh, and Vriska, Solix figured you wouldn't have a phone, so he gave this to me to give to you. It has everyone's number in it.
She handed Vriska a simple black BlackBerry. On the back of it was a little sticker decal of a set of white teeth with long fangs.
No fucking way.
Vriska snatched it up greedily. Damn it, I owe that nerd a favor now.
Thank you, Feferi, Kanaya said. Perhaps this is a first step towards a return to normalcy.
Feferi saw that she was trying not to squeeze the foam with her fingers. Kanaya's brow tightened.
Did you say your mom?
The amber-tinted girl suddenly seemed to shiver. Feferi hugged her again, speaking quietly.
I'm so sorry, Kanaya. I think you and your friends found my contact ritual. I had it to stay in touch with her, but I lost it during the catastrophe. I thought it was destroyed by the meteors or washed out to sea.
Feferi sniffled, feeling her eyes well up.
My mom probably thought you did something to me. Nobody else should have been able to work the ritual. That's why it was in a dead language. She's more than a person. She doesn't think like us. I heard her calling. She was so angry she couldn't find me, and then there were a bunch of protective wards around her, maybe with wizard magic. She's really never met a wizard she didn't hate, and since she can't really communicate with you, she must have just...
Feferi, Kanaya said calmly, patting her back in the softest, most delicate of motions. Feferi was struck with a sudden guilt.
Tarnus, I've been blabbering all over you,
she sniffled.
I was supposed to be the one here to comfort you, not the other way around. I'm sorry.
It's all right, Kanaya said.
Your mother... Carcat told me I was attacked by a being of pure chaos. By more than a person, do you mean your mom is a being from the in-between places? A true chthonic entity?
Feferi nodded a response, too miserable to say it. Terezi had offered absolution, placing the blame at Rose's feet for meddling with the unknown. But Mom should never have been within meddling distance, and it was Feferi's mistakes that had delivered her heirloom into two curious hands. Her mistakes had cost Kanaya her real body, her normal life. With the deep ocean and her pod so far out of reach, Feferi knew the depth of Kanaya's loss. She didn't think it could be forgiven.
In that case, she's a force of nature. Not something to be controlled or bargained with. I would never think you were the one to blame for actions she took in rage. In defense of her daughter, after seeing me holding her gift to you and presuming the worst from your absence, if you thought your heirloom had sunk or broken, and that it was unreadable if found, there's no sensible reason you would have needed to inform us of such an item.
Feferi felt a rush of gratitude for Kanaya for her kindness and understanding. She'd worried Kanaya would shun her. Now she just felt foolish for misjudging her friend. Carcat grumbled from behind Feferi.
None of this bullshit is sensible. I don't blame you either, but what are the fucking odds?
It's not something I wanted word to get around about,
Feferi said, feeling small.
If any powerful people heard of a contact rune from Imam, well...
There would have been an arms race to find it, Vriska said, having sat back down, her arms crossed.
I think you did the smart thing.
How'd the witch find it, anyway?
She jabbed her thumb towards the elevator. Kanaya coughed.
Well, funny thing.
Suddenly everyone was staring at Kanaya, Feferi included. That tone meant something not funny was about to be shared.
We may or may not have found it in Games Shop.
Kanaya trailed off into an inaudible mutter.
Don't fucking mess around, Kanaya. Where the hell did she find it?
Carcat urged.
Gamzee's shop,
Kanaya said carefully. Vriska barked a disbelieving laugh. Carcat looked like his lid was about to blow. Feferi was just...
Gamzee? How did Gamzee of all people find it?
It wasn't a question of shapeshifters. Feferi knew some exceedingly normal shapeshifters, but a question of Gamzee. Carcat suddenly smacked his forehead.
Burn my fucking bridge and sundry!
Kanaya cringed in realization, but Feferi was lost. She'd never been to Gamzee's store. She'd always meant to, but kept finding reasons not to visit. Reasons not to watch how easily he shifted, how beautifully fluid his movements became as he took on whatever form suited him. Reasons to ignore the tiniest hint of jealousy.
He installed that sign the moment we came out of the bunkers.
Kanaya turned to Feferi, noticing her confusion.
He sells seashells and such. He would have gathered his supply before you even thought it safe to search, given the durability his nature grants him.
Feferi put her hands on her head and made a noise of frustration.
Are you kidding me? If I just told my friends about it, I would have had my tablet 3 years ago.
I think Rose purchased it for $20 and some pies, Kanaya said, mostly to herself.
Only 20 clams?
Oh, I'd be having a talk with him.
Feferi balled her fists.
Hey, Pikesies.
Vriska spoke up. You should probably go grab your bone before you plan any revenge schemes. Vriska gestured behind her.
It's not revenge, just...
Feferi's eyes followed where Vriska had pointed. Sitting on some kind of science tray, there it was. It seemed to pulse in her vision like a beating heart calling to her. Her connection to her mother, it had been mentioned to her mother. It had been so long. Feferi walked over, fighting the urge to break out into a run.
Feferi,
said Carcat, catching up to her. She turned to him and he spoke quietly.
We're going to have to talk to that woman in the lab coat before you can get your tablet back, and we don't need her or the hunter thinking you're a threat. Just follow my lead, please.
Wide-eyed, Feferi nodded, letting Carcat walk ahead of her. She hadn't even noticed the tall, blonde lady sitting in the chair at the desk her tablet was on.
Doctor,
he said tersely.
The woman whipped around. The glass in her hand that smelled potently of gin came much too close to sloshing out with the movement.
Kakat.
Her eyes drifted over to Feferi. They were a frightening shade of pink.
Is this lovely young lady our missing bone owner?
Don't fucking call her that, but yes, the tablet is hers. If you have questions, you're gonna make them quick, and she'll only answer them if she wants to, got it?
Kakat said.
For the last time, I don't want anything but information. Come here, honey, take a seat,
the doctor said, pulling a rolling stool out from under the desk. With a nod from Karkat, Feferi walked over and sat down. The tablet was only inches away, and it took her some willpower not to just reach out and grab it.
Fantastic, I'm Dr. Lalande. You are?
Feferi Pixies, she said carefully.
Wonderful, I'm a Sagittarius. Your hair is so pretty. Wow, how did you get it like that?
The doctor asked.
Salt water?
Feferi offered, confused. The doctor said wow again, quietly, her hand raised like she wanted to touch it.
You know, I always hear that, but I just don't think
The real questions?
Karkat interrupted. He shot the doctor a mean look that she didn't seem to notice, but she sighed nonetheless.
Write the questions,
and she pulled out a clipboard with a blank sheet of paper on it.
This tablet, what is the nature of its usage?
The doctor's tone switched to utterly clinical.
It's ritual instructions for calling.
She glanced at Karkat, who made a go-on gesture.
Me, ma'am, I use it to keep in contact with her when I'm traveling.
Your mom, she isn't a Selkie?
The doctor said it like a question, but with a tone that was matter of fact.
No, she's very ancient and very powerful and very chaotic. I don't know what your word for her would be.
Feferi fiddled with her hands.
Is she a god?
The doctor probed.
God-like,
Feferi said. It was as apt of a descriptor as she could manage.
Greater eldritch entity, the doctor said aloud as she wrote. Does she make a habit of protruding into cities and causing destruction?
No,
Feferi said, affronted. This is the first time anything like this has happened. She minds her business in the ocean and protects the pod, that's it.
I just need a grasp on some kind of history of events that have involved her,
the doctor explained.
If I can do anything for Kanaya's state, I'll need to know if something like this has already occurred. Does she curse people, change their bodies?
Feferi shook her head.
When she does protect us, she just...
She made a fist and flicked all her fingers outward, mimicking an explosion of tentacles.
Attacks? I've never heard of anyone like Kanaya before.
The doctor nodded and finished scribbling something in incomprehensible doctor script on her clipboard.
I had a feeling. That said, I'd like to do one last thing for reference.
She turned to her desk and came back around with a vial and a needle.
Chaos magic is unpredictable. Even if you haven't heard of her doing anything like this, there's still a chance. A sample of your DNA and an identification ritual would help me greatly to rule out some causes of Kanaya's condition.
Feferi wasn't afraid of needles. She'd had too many fishhooks stuck in her for that, but the extraction part still made her feel icky. That the extraction would be used to perform a wizardly ritual with all the sickening order that entailed. She must have made a face because Karkat stepped in again.
You don't need to, he said. Feferi shook her head.
No, if it has even a chance of helping Kanaya.
She looked back at her friend.
It's just a little blood.
That's what I like to hear,
the doctor said before sliding on a pair of medical gloves. In short order, Feferi saw her blood sloshing around in a vial of viscous raspberry tint to it. The doctor pressed a cotton ball to her arm for a few moments before returning with an offering of three plasters spread out in her grip. One was a plain beige, one bore the image of a pink and white cat waving outward, and the last was a dark blue with a tiled shark print. It was hardly a choice. Feferi peeled and stuck the blue bandage on her arm.
Now if you'll just follow me.
The doctor peeled off the gloves and gathered a variety of magical-looking components up in her arms from the desk. She then walked over to the lab bench within the circle and plopped her items down on it. Kanaya, Vriska, Mama, and Dave were still gathered around the exam table. It looked like the hunter had joined them and was speaking to his brother quietly. Despite Kanaya sitting on the table and Dave on the chair, there was still a bit of a cluster that must have been too close to the lab bench for the doctor's comfort.
Just going to grab this,
the doctor said, sliding the bench with a horrible metal shriek into a more open area of the circle, dragging it further away from the observation table. She blissfully ignored the various glances the group threw her way as she did so.
Feferi exchanged a glance with Karkat, who shrugged and shook his head. He lacked any insights into their host's quirks, apparently. As soon as Feferi and Karkat stepped within the bounds of the circle markings on the floor, a glowing pink bubble flared up around them.
Whoa!
Feferi exclaimed as she watched the surface scintillate and sparkle. She knew better than to examine it with her second sight, but with her normal eyes, it was just a pretty pink light show. Whatever ugly pattern of order was underneath, she didn't care to see it.
Try not to touch it, the doctor said, the slightest smile on her face. It responds in kind to force applied, so you should be fine if you do, but it's best not to take the risk.
She then placed her implements out on the table and in the bowl.
Stand across from me, please, Feferi.
A few moments later, pink flames flared up from a small bowl as the doctor chanted something to herself in a whisper that sounded suspiciously like prayer. She wasn't sure her mom would approve of her involvement in something so steeped in the divine, so she did her best not to listen to the words, to just focus on the flame. It really was a pretty light show. The doctor's hand gripped the cup of water she'd prepared. She continued the chant as she raised it above the flames. As the doctor tipped the glass, the water fell. It splashed quietly to the bottom of the bowl, no hiss, no steam. A plume of stench rose out of the bowl, rotting seaweed and salt. The flames stopped flickering, only they didn't go out. Feferi stared at the unmoving fire. It looked as though someone had pressed pause on a recorded video of fire. She might have assumed time stopped, but the doctor kept chanting, her eyes closed.
Doctor,
Feferi said quietly. The doctor's eyes did not open, and she continued her incantation. She grasped the quill and dipped it down towards the fire, and before Feferi or Karkat could stop her, it poked up against one of the licks of flame. The fire wobbled, then fell over. Fire, solid, clacked against the table like glass, shattering as it impacted. Feferi felt a fleck of it hit her cheek. She reached up to wipe it off and found that it was cold. Melting, the fire had become ice.
Holy shit,
she heard Vriska from behind her. Am I the only normal alt in this room? Feferi gulped and watched as the doctor scrawled something across the paper that she couldn't read, certainly not while it was upside down. The doctor opened her eyes and stopped chanting. Looking down to read the paper, it took a moment for her to realize that the fire was both unextinguished and unmoving.
Oh, that's... Well, I've never seen that before.
She picked up a chunk of the ice fire and rubbed it between her fingers.
Your results.
She leaned over and handed Feferi the paper. While she was close, she whispered,
The phrasing is pretty useless, but it says Selkie and beyond, if you're curious.
Feferi looked at the text, which read, Selkie Atlantica Atque Ultra. Instead of ink or blood, the words were written in ichor. Feferi hadn't the slightest idea how frozen flames could produce it.
I think that's all I needed to know, the doctor said, examining the frozen fire. Thank you for all of your cooperation, Feferi. You are a wonderful subject if you ever want to stop by again and run some...
That's enough. Come on, Feferi, let's grab your bone and get you the fuck out of here before she decides she wants your skeleton.
Karkat ushered Feferi over to the desk. The doctor looked a little disappointed, but she started carefully collecting the shards of frozen pink flame.
Elsevier, but Karkat, I'm also curious about that decision.
The hunter had appeared in front of both of them. Was he flexing, or were his arms just that toned?
You just sending this girl off with this lethal artifact?
The hunter's questions were aimed at the doctor, who appeared to be sticking the frozen flames in a lab freezer. Feferi took offense at his phrasing. She was a woman. Thank you very much.
Well, sure, she said. It's not like we have any way to safely store it or destroy it. If Miss Feferi here says it's safe when she uses it, well, she seems like a trustworthy young lady.
The hunter sighed. Looking up at him, Feferi thought she saw bags underneath his eyes, where the shades didn't reach. He turned his attention to her.
You're in the little soup kitchen down in the Buffalo.
He asked like an accusation.
Yes, Monday through Friday, starting at 11 until we run out, though we try to have stuff in the cooler for anyone that comes outside of ours. she said, meeting his shaded eyes and speaking calmly, hoping she came across as polite and cooperative. He was supposed to be reasonable after all. The hunter drummed his finger against his crossed arms. He turned his head just barely enough to glance at Mama through the corner of his eye. He set his jaw.
You've done a lot of good. So I'm going to say you can take your artifact back, but I better not see so much as a single tentacle poke into this city again. If I catch wind of any eldritch activity, you're going to be my first stop.
Feferi swallowed and nodded quickly. Karkat sneered.
And you'll be my first stop if I find any of my friends' bodies disposed of like a hacky mob hit. Come on, Fetheria, I need you to get out of here.
He gestured to the artifact. Feferi grabbed it, and it immediately felt pleasantly cool to the touch, like the gentle tides of the Irish Sea in her hands, pulling her to comfort and safety. Karkat walked her to the elevator as she slid the tablet into her backpack and closed it tight.
Look, I'm not trying to force you out of here, but I need someone to get the word to all our friends around about the situation. It'll be a lot better to talk to them in person rather than try to get everyone to read it in between a bunch of roleplay and typos.
He sighed, looking down at his phone. Don't worry, Karkat. I get it. Frankly, I thought the doctor was kind of fishy and not in a good way. I'll get the word cleared up with everybody.
Karkat looked like a weight lifted off his shoulders, though he was still slouching.
You're the best, Feferi. Oh, and while you're talking to Solix or Gamzee even, ask about sourcing some more blood for these two specifically.
He nodded towards Kanaya and Vriska. The latter was trying to mooch a sip off the former's blood bag.
You can count on me.
Feferi pumped her fist, knowing everyone was safe and getting to help them too. This was shaping up to be a fantastic day.
John.
Jonathan, it's time for us to finish my spell.
The clack of heels and the stilted, overly enunciated declaration signaled Rose's mom approaching. Dad stood, hastily straightening his tie and brushing off the front of his slacks. He smiled, outstretching his hand for her to shake.
John also stood. The name is John Egbert, Sr. It's a pleasure to meet you, he stated.
She delicately peeled off her latex gloves, tossing them in a nearby trash bin before stepping close, both hands reaching to grasp his. John could only watch, with shocked surprise, as the woman leaned down, pressing her pale pink lips to his dad's hand, leaving a cartoonishly perfect lipstick kiss on dad's skin. John's jaw dropped.
Enchanté.
She squeezed dad's hand gently before unfurling herself back to a standing position.
The name is Dr. Roxanne Lalande, and the pleasure is all mine, I assure you.
She smiled, and suddenly John realized that all of her preceding smiles that morning had been fake. He hadn't realized before, but once he compared the previous stiffness to the way her whole face looked alive and animated, the difference was stark. She had been cordial with everyone else. She was being flirtatious with Dad.
What the fuck?
Are you ready to see some up-close and personal magic, John?
She said playfully, her gaze never leaving Dad's. John felt heat in his cheeks and saw it reflected in his dad's face. She was flirting with his dad and using John's name to do it.
Anything to help my son, Doctor?
His dad, thank God, was perfectly polite, stressing her title as a reminder that he wasn't here to socialize. John let out an audible, whoops, sigh of relief.
Of course, anything
for our children, she murmured, still way too far in Dad's personal space, thank you very much.
Doc, can we get this done? I want Dave sent home with the Egberts. He's fallen asleep standing up. The quicker we get John here identified, the quicker Jonathan can drive the boys and Vriska home.
Dave's bro had crept up behind John, apparently, and the sound of his voice made John flinch in surprise. The dude smirked a little, clearly showing off his weirdo ninja skills for some reason. Jerk.
Of course, Broderick, if you don't come with me, we can get the magic started. I can't promise it'll be as interesting as Kanaya or Feferi, but we should get our answers.
With that, she finally backed out of Dad's space, turning on her heels and click-clacking her way back to the workbench. The men all followed behind her, and once they were all standing in front of the bowl with John's blood in it, she twisted her wrist in that strange motion, the crackling dome of pink energy once again encircling the space.
Dr. Lalonde, why are you locking us back in here if Kanaya is okay now?
John hesitantly asked, warily watching the electric field of magic dance in the air.
That's a good question, she praised,
seemingly back in that weird science teacher mode again. Identification spells are very powerful. They ask the goddess to help the wizard identify inherent truths about a person. That's why it requires all those ingredients we spoke about before. The thing about inherent truth about identity is that it isn't always information you want freely available to people. That's why Feferi took her identification with her when she left. When I perform rituals that reveal sensitive information, my circle helps protect that information. If someone were to attempt to scry on me right now, they'd be unable to see past the circle. If someone wished to take advantage of my trance state to attack me, the circle would ensure I am not vulnerable. And if the spell goes wrong, resulting in magical blowback, the circle should catch it, preventing structural damage to the building. Does that make sense? She looked at him across the workbench and he nodded. It made sense.
If there's a chance of magical blowback, shouldn't the other children and Mr. Gray, Broderick, and Mama Grubb all be outside the circle for their protection?
Dad asked, concern obvious. John had to wonder if he was onto something there. He hadn't seen Feferi's identification, but he had watched Kanaya's from right next to her. The idea of his hands tearing open in front of Dad's and everyone else, it was so painful she had fainted. He wasn't sure he could handle that kind of thing happening to him.
I have quite the success rate. The only reason I even mention blowback is the risk for younger, inexperienced practitioners. I've been in the practice since I met Jade's grandfather back in my teenage years. The last time I dealt with magical blowback, it was before I'd graduated high school.
She seemed a bit smug, like she had been when telling John not to bother restraining Kanaya. He hoped she didn't plan to show off her magical combat skills again.
Well, I would still feel more comfortable if you put safety first. It appears these kids were lacking a good example when it comes to magic. Perhaps this would be enlightening.
Dad didn't seem impressed, putting on a stern tone that made John cringe internally. He looked over at Dave's bro, who was following the conversation silently. He was wearing the classic Strider poker face, not reacting to Dave's reprimand.
I suppose they don't need to be present for the most part, she allowed, and twisted her wrist the other way. The circle falling.
She cleared her throat, raising her voice.
Everyone not essential out of the circle, this chair's against the wall, make use of them.
Dad watched as Kanaya, her mom, Dave, and Vriska all exited the circle space. He then turned to look at Dave's bro, waiting.
I want to see the result when it happens. I ain't moving, he said.
And the doctor turned to Mr. Gray, who was walking towards them. He went to stand on the other side of Dave's bro, away from John and Dad.
Same here. I need to see this shit happen live. It concerns the elders,
he said, scowling as though expecting an argument. The wizard simply shrugged, raising the circle once more.
All right, then I suppose we can get started,
she said cheerily, pulling a bowl forward. It contained a lump of bentonite clay, John realized. It clearly wasn't the bowl she'd already mixed up before Kanaya's spell went wrong.
Fresh spell, fresh ingredients. Grab a vial of your blood, would you? She asked,
beginning to drizzle some frankincense oil over the clay. He reached past his dad to the rack of vials, ignoring the freaky monster colors of the girls in favor of his own, totally normal, red blood. The wizard used the pestle to mush the oil into the clay, then gestured at John for the blood. He poured it into the bowl, trying to evenly distribute it. She used a spoon to mix it all together.
Once again, when I light the fire, I'll be in my trance until it's over. Are we ready?
She looked at the men, then at John, standing between them.
Ready as I'll ever be, I guess, he said, and she nodded, scooping up her flint and steel.
With a flourish, she sparked the mixture to flame, again an alluringly bright pink that matched the glow around her head and hands. Her eyes were unnaturally bright, the glow nearly hurting John's eyes with the intensity. He could feel the heat rolling off of her, as warm as the bowl of flames between them. Although her prayers were not audible, each movement of her whisper-quiet lips was enough to send goosebumps down John's spine. This had happened last time, too, like the feeling of someone walking over his grave, as Nana Nina used to say. It was yet another in a stream of strange sensations, the flow of which had steadily increased over the past few days. He hoped this spell would provide some answers for it. Janet thought there was a strange halo around the flames of Kanaya's spell before a dark purple color, like the skin of a grape. He'd planned to ask Vriska about it, but she was a bit busy, perching over Kanaya like a cute gargoyle. John had also thought there was a strange halo around his own flames the last time. This time he tried to focus on them. While the color was that bright neon pink, there was a definite discoloration in the air around the flames. It was lighter than the near-black grape color, much lighter and bluer, too. It was blue like his magic had been, a bright, sparkling color which grew stronger as the flames crackled on. Nobody else seemed to acknowledge the blue coloration. It might have been something only he could see, like the wards or the auras in the clearing. The wizard poured her water over the flames, and the dark, reddish-black ink that resulted was pristine, as she dipped her quill into it. They looked expectantly at the paper that she pulled close, prayers still ghosting out with each breath. John prepared himself for a string of unintelligible Latin, same as with the others. It looked that way at first until he noticed the letters moving. It was like they were animated off the page, bending, twisting, rearranging until words formed. Sacred spark of eternal flame greeted him. Dark, bloody ink that glimmered with a blue halo just like the flames. With a final murmured, "Thank you, goddess," the glow on the wizard ceased, though the glow on the words remained.
"Doc, what the hell is that supposed to mean?"
Dave Sproul asked harshly, glaring down at the paper through his glasses. Whatever he was seeing, it couldn't be good. She didn't reply for a moment, staring down at the paper, brow furrowed. When she finally looked up, she stared at John, then Dad, then John again.
"Sacris Quintilla Flammi, Attorney?"
"It's nothing to worry about, and nothing to bother the other hunters with. I have to run a few tests to confirm, of course, but I think it's safe to say that the boy can go home with his father. After the rest of the tests are complete, the Egberts can come back here and I can explain more. For now, I want him to go home and rest. Nothing else needs to be done." She nodded as she spoke, a display of her own satisfaction. Dad opened his mouth to press her further, but Mr. Gray beat him to the punch in that harsh, gravelly voice.
"Respectfully, you wizards are absolute shit at conveying information. Am I supposed to tell the elders that we have a guy in our city who simply woke up one day with magic and dragon strength without any idea of what he is? Is he just a dragon that never figured out how to switch forms?"
The dude seemed really pissed about the whole thing, and John frowned at him. Leaning across Dave's bro to look at him, it was hard to tell with the whole stone thing, but he was pretty sure the guy was actually a teenager.
"What the heck makes it your business anyway? What do a bunch of old people want with me? Are you part of some secret club like Uncle Iroh?"
John snarked at him and did his best to hide a smile when the guy started fuming. Was that literal steam coming from his head weird?
"I'll tell you what makes it my business, Egg Derp. You're looking at one of the leaders of Houston right here, one of the people responsible for keeping a multi-species city from falling into chaos when the humans are ill-equipped to handle us. If you're an alternative, you fall under my jurisdiction. If you're a human doing evil magic, you fall under the hunters. I'm trying to figure out if I should be inviting you to my community meetings or if you need to be on house arrest like Rose. Excuse me for wanting a real answer,"
he groused, a masterful scowl contorting his features. The guy's eyes were intense. Not bright like magic, but bright like a ruby or something. They were kind of pretty, almost. Totally ruined the effect of being some sort of confident, badass adult who put this guy in charge.
"No need to get testy, Mr. Gray. The boy has full control over his abilities. As long as he doesn't attempt to practice his magic without my tutelage, there is nothing to worry about. You can tell the elders that he is an alternative, one thought extinct. I'm going to take his father's blood as well, and I expect the result will be the same. They are not dragons, but I cannot disclose anything further."
She immediately began rummaging around in her pockets, producing a fresh syringe and 6 empty vials. "You think I have these powers too? Why me? I'm no slouch on the bench press, but I built my strength like the rest of the fellows." Dad's brow was furrowed, and he sounded a little put out by the suggestion that he was naturally talented rather than hard-working. John wasn't sure how to feel about that.
"My former boss used to study this sort of thing. He taught me about the subject that's called a hunch until I have your blood for DNA and some more magical testing. It's a bit slower than what you saw here, but we'll provide the complete picture."
She paused for a moment, a glass suddenly in her hand, and she sipped at the potent concoction thoughtfully. Sip completed, she waved her other hand in a lazy gesture at Dave's bro and Mr. Gray. The Egberts can come back later in the week and we can discuss results then, including the precise details of what their heritage may entail, without all these political and martial elements breathing down your neck. She narrowed her eyes and scowled in a movement that seemed exaggerated, theatrical. John eyed her glass dubiously.
Out of curiosity, John, was your mother the free-spirited type?
She asked his dad out of nowhere. He blinked.
She was open-hearted and curious about the world, if you're insinuating something about my parentage, however.
His father began raising his voice sternly.
No. Just a curiosity. Your extinct heritage is on record with certain tendencies, is all.
The doctor bounced her foot, as it seemed like a train of thought had caught and dragged her away.
But,
the doctor snapped back to the present, seeing as your son managed to draw my blood when I tried to stick him, you can tap your own vein, John. I'll simply supervise. And there she went again, fluttering her eyelashes as she called him the wrong name. Jeez. John rolled his eyes and looked away, content to eavesdrop on Mr. Gray's muttered string of expletives as he began texting loudly. In short order, Dad drew his own blood, and the carefully labeled tubes were placed on the rack. With that complete, the circle was taken down. Dad started discussing with Dave's bro about Dave and Vriska coming home with them, but John wasn't really listening. Nor was he bothering to make small talk with Mr. Gray, or engage with Rosa's mother, who was taking increasingly long sips of her drink. John instead was staring at that paper, at the clear and obvious words written upon it in plain English. At the way the ink glowed blue, despite its black-red color, he was thinking about the way the doctor had very carefully not answered, that she'd said he had control, that he was something extinct. How could he have missed it, sitting so obviously in front of his face? He was Superman. The revelation was interrupted by a shout. Vriska was up again, hackles raised as Bro went and told her that she'd be leaving. Without Kanaya.
You think I'm just going to leave her with Dr. fucking Frankenstein over there, fat chance?
Kanaya started trying to bring Vriska back down without touching her, but Vriska shook off her efforts. The doctor laughed bitterly.
Of the two of us, I'm the only one who hasn't promised violence at every juncture.
Sure. You just went ahead and did it without warning, Vriska snarled.
Is that why your daughter went away without a fuss, too?
Something overcame the doctor's expression. The ones John had seen so far were carefree tipsiness, educational professionalism, and lechery, much to his own misfortune. This was fury. The doctor stalked towards Vriska, her heels sounding like pickaxes against the metal floor. Her shoulders were brought up, and John saw pink energy coiling around her forearms like angry boas. A second ago, he thought the color was incongruent with mystical power. But seeing it roil in the doctor's grasp like a toxin, like the sky on fire at sunset, he was suddenly very afraid of the light red. Vriska's demeanor had changed entirely. John first thought was of wolves in nature documentaries when one asserted dominance over another, the way the ears flattened, the limbs went tight and shrunk their body towards the ground. Vriska was more than afraid, she was cowed. It didn't make sense. She'd gone up against the hunter without hesitation, and that guy could move so fast that he disappeared. Mama Grub and Kanaya stood up as the arcane power filled the air, and so did Dad. Before they could intercede, the doctor spoke.
Get the hell out of my lab!
She shook her arms and turned, the magic dissipating. The room was quiet, save the sound of her heels on the way back to her desk. The hunter shook his head and sighed.
Appreciate it, Jonathan, he said as he passed Dad, following after the doctor.
Dad cleared his throat.
All right, kids, let's get moving. I think I parked in a fire lane.
He made an attempt at humor. Vriska still looked shell-shocked and was staring at the ground. Kanaya was gently trying to get her attention. John exchanged a glance with Dave, who shrugged. John decided on at least checking with her.
Hey, Vriska, are you okay?
He asked, careful to keep his voice level. She didn't meet his eyes. It was like someone flicked her off switch. Kanaya looked at him, concern writ large all over her face.
Vriska, I'll be all right. My mom is here. Nothing will happen that she doesn't allow. You'd be safer if you leave, at least until I learn to control my strength.
Would you...
Kanaya kept trying and failing to get Vriska to look at her.
John, please assist me with our contact.
What? John asked.
Hold her head still so I can get through to her.
Kanaya demanded. John wasn't certain that garnered a reaction from Vriska, but he thought he might have seen her pupils dilate slightly.
I don't think just... You know, as a guy, I should really...
John, you killed me. You're the only person I know I can touch without hurting. You must atone, Kanaya said menacingly.
Dave snorted a laugh that he failed to cover up with an obviously fake coughing fit, which she completely ignored.
Was Kanaya messing with him? She continued staring at John expectantly, no sign of jest on her face. Well, he supposed he couldn't exactly argue about it.
John walked over, Kanaya gesturing for him to stand behind her. He raised his arms, and Kanaya grabbed them by the elbows. She brought them over her shoulders, like she was about to give him a piggyback ride. Her firm grip, he realized, would have injured anyone else in the room. Severely, probably. With his arms as a proxy, Kanaya fastened Vriska's head straight, then down. So she had nowhere else to look but Kanaya's face. Vriska's skin was smooth and cool, though her hair was unpleasantly stringy. John craned his neck skywards so he wouldn't be staring at Vriska while touching her face.
Vriska? You forced me to enlist John to get this message through to you. I hope you understand that. You have stood for me valiantly through this entire endeavor. I do not intend to forget it, but I won't have you injured by some volatile change in my condition for the sake of my comfort or for the sake of your dedication. I am safe. And you still need to recover, lest I remind you of the state of your leg not but 2 days ago. You need to go say hello to the rest of our friends as well. I'm certain Everton is chomping at the bit to finally play that war game of yours. Will you go and do this?
For me?
Kanaya asked. John felt Riska's head nod slowly.
You're one of my dearest friends. I would hug you now if it didn't risk your life,
Kanaya said, a smile in her voice. John felt Vriska push forward and let go. He awkwardly stepped back as Vriska hugged Kanaya, and Kanaya stood as still as she could. Eventually, they released, and Vriska quickly walked away with a thick, "Let's go." John's dad hurried after, gesturing for the boys to follow. Unsure what to say, John idled next to Kanaya for a moment. An idea itched in the back of his mind, the word atone echoing. She looked at him, her eyebrows raised, clearly waiting for him to speak. Impulsively, John reached out and hugged Kanaya, pulling her into an embrace, just as he'd given Jade. Kanaya was stiff in his arms for a moment, but she hadn't moved out of his way nor asked him to let go.
I'm sure I'm not at the top of your list, but, it's like you said, you can touch me without her hurting me. I kind of figured you might want a chance to hug somebody back.
He offered his reasoning, suddenly aware of how silly it sounded. But then Kanaya moved, and she embraced him in return, wrapping her arms around him. He was ready for it, but still, as her arms squeezed against his braced core, he fought to keep his lungs from emptying.
Rose always told me you were the kind of friend that just knew what someone needed.
Without them even having to ask, I'm appreciative of your friendship, John. Thank you.
John smiled.
Don't mention it. I'll see you around.
Kanaya nodded. Glancing back towards her mom, John turned and followed his dad. Dave caught up next to him as they were walking to the elevator, and wordlessly showed him his phone. A picture of Kanaya pressing the arms of a beet-red John to Vriska's face on the screen. His dad in the background, looking confused.
You jerk, delete that!
John whispered, yelled at Dave, who laughed at him and jerked the phone away before he could get a hand on it.
Wait, man, this is going to scrapbook. I'm gonna lovingly decorate the page with little heart-shaped rhinestones, title it John's First Three-Way, hella platonically, of course.
He snickered,
waggling his brows above his shades. John stuck out his tongue at his friend, and as they joined Dad and Vriska in the hall by the elevator, he began plotting his prankster's revenge. They'd been invited to a party this week, right? Maybe he could hide something in a cake. The four rode the elevator in silence. John stood close to his dad, as much as he could without it being awkward. Of course, he was glad Dad was there, but he was mostly using him as a wall to hide from Vriska. Thankfully, she seemed to share the sentiment, pressed up against the opposite wall, her arms crossed. When the doors opened, she was the first one out.
"I appreciate her being prompt, but really the car should be fine. It's only half in a fire lane," his dad said.
John was slightly worried Vriska would disappear once she left the hotel and they would lose her, but she was frozen at the glass doors, looking out. Rain fell gently to the ground outside, covering everything in a wet sheen.
"Oh, damn, yeah, Vriska melts in the rain and rivers and shit,"
Dave said, the last one out of the elevator. John spotted a bin full of umbrellas. It was a remnant of the miserable blessings of the catastrophe. A lot of things were left around, and those who survived could just grab an umbrella or a laptop or a car or a house or a storefront. John tried not to think of what kind of person would have left the practical black umbrella he ended up grabbing. Vriska turned at the sound of his approach, her features contorted in disgust, but fading to neutrality as her focus shifted from rain to him. John stuck the handle of the umbrella out to her.
"You probably will want to hold on to one of these. There's been a lot of rain since I got here, at least."
Vriska looked from the umbrella to John, then nodded once, reaching forward and accepting the umbrella. As she did so, he noticed some silver-tinged stitching glinting in the light, giving her left arm a decidedly Frankensteinian appearance. It was kind of badass, actually.
"Thanks," she muttered.
He thought she might say something else, but Dad and Dave were upon them, the former presenting his own umbrella and the latter taking the liberty to acquire a bright red one from the bin.
"The past few days were getting downright sunny. It's a shame to see it pass," Dad said.
He looked at the trio, smiling warmly.
"When we get to the apartment, I'm going to make you all hot chocolate to banish the chill. And then we can kick off this sleepover with a movie marathon. You kids ready to brave the rain?"
Somehow in the scramble, John had lost his claim to shotgun, ending up in the back seat alongside Vriska while Dave sat in the front. Actually, it was more like slumped, really. They'd barely begun to drive and he was already passing out. John turns to his left to look at Vriska, intending to ask if she really would have dissolved, but found her staring intently at Rose's building as they slowly crept away from it. Her brow was furrowed in concern.
"Kanaya's going to be fine,"
John blurted out. Then immediately mentally kicked himself. He doubled down as Vriska turned to face him.
I mean, she is fine, and she's going to stay that way. The adults had a plan to help her, right? And it must have been working because she wasn't freaking out anymore, and really she was more worried about you."
"Nobody needs to worry about me,"
Vriska said, sounding louder than she might have intended. Her nails were dug into the cushion of the car seat.
"So some psycho bitch almost threw magic at me. Fucking whatever. It's not like I haven't dealt with that my whole life. I got out, and now I'm fine. Drop it."
Her jaw clenched, and she made a point of not looking at him. Great going, Egbert, real smooth.
No worries. Dropping it."
He put up his hands in a placating gesture, futile as it was. But of course he wouldn't let a bad mood get in the way of potential friendship, especially if they were going to have a sleepover.
"It's really cool that you're here anyway. You and Jade both made it to Houston. Isn't that lucky?"
At that, she turned to look at him, a startled expression momentarily widening her eyes and raising her brows before she forced her expression back into neutral. "If luck was involved in either me or your friend getting here, then we might really be screwed," she said somberly. "You better pray to your goddess that it was mere coincidence we arrived the same week, and our own hard work that we made it here at all." With that, she turned back to the window. John briefly considered asking her what the heck that was supposed to mean, but something within him kept his mouth shut. Instead, he found himself looking out his own window as the car turned a corner, Rose's building about to leave his sight. He was really glad Rose wasn't in bigger trouble, and it was great that Jade was keeping her company, but he'd wished the girls were crammed in the car with him instead. It didn't seem fair that the four of them couldn't be together. He felt a deep, sudden urge to ask Dad to turn the car around to bring him back to Jade. Eerily similar to those prior feelings, those odd senses of certainty he'd had that Jade was so, so close. He now felt that connection like a hook through his spine. Hot, like the power that pressed against his sternum, a burning desire to close the distance between them. And then the building was out of sight, and he shifted in discomfort. Was he just being emotional, or was this a genuine example of his powers? He had no way to be sure. But then he remembered Jade, the way she'd done magic with ease, destroying the cuffs on Rose and the chair she was chained to. Maybe he couldn't see Jade in person for a little while, but that didn't mean he couldn't talk to her, right?
May 7th, 11:35 a.m. E.B.
Hey, Rose, can you give Jade and me Dave's numbers? Also, I'm glad you only got grounded. Let me know if you need anything, okay?
For the full text of this and other stories by the same authors, visit the AO3 pages of Madam Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Constant Conquest by Michael Guy Bowman. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information on my website, which is located at sangabrielvo.com. And there you can learn about other stories that I've read, my Discord server, and ways to support what I do. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.